Blog Talk Radio.
And the theme for this week's Cosmic Citizen Show will be unique approaches to outreach, introducing the book to large numbers of new and young readers by focusing on particular niches of interest. On this program, we focus on reaching out to UFO enthusiasts as well as spiritual practitioners. Our first hour, we're going to be interviewing Don Ware. Don is a lieutenant colonel, retired from the U.S. Air Force. He's at Fort Walton Beach, Florida. He's a UFO researcher and lecturer. He's the head of the International UFO Congress. He's the director.
I'm a director, one of the six U.S. directors.
Okay. Anyway, I'd like to introduce Don. Don, hello. Welcome to the show this morning. Thank
you.
Well,
good morning, Crystalline. Good talking with you.
Thank you. Well, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the work you do and the different organizations in the UFO community that you're associated with?
I can do that. I'd like to give you a very quick, brief rundown on how I got to where I am. My card says I'm a truth seeker and birder. I fell in love with birds when I was 7. Now I use professional bird guides to take me into many exotic places around the world. I've been in 120-some countries and have been able to find and identify 5,093 species of birds.
Oh, my.
That has increased my serious love affair with Mother Earth. I've been a truth seeker. Right. I've been a truth seeker since I was 16 years old when I saw 7 red light type UFOs flying around over Washington, D.C. that made headlines around the world 2 Sunday mornings in a row. And
wow.
That started my path as a truth seeker. I've now seen alien vehicles 9 times, the last in 1993 here in Fort Walton Beach. The first paranormal experience on my journey that I recall that I now recognize as a paranormal experience was when I was 18 as a student, engineering student at Duke University. I'd been in a philosophical discussion with my fraternity brothers until midnight, went to bed, woke up at 2. With all this information in my mind, I felt like I had to get up and write down, and I did. It said, basically, I only have one ambition, and that's to be the happiest man in the world.
Wow.
And what it takes to make me happy is a little more than my share of 3 things: love, excitement, and self-satisfaction, or the feeling that I'm doing something worthwhile. I now realize I was at a decision point in my career as to whether I would commit to the U.S. Air Force. And that experience helped me realize there was ample opportunity to find those ingredients of happiness as an Air Force officer, especially a fighter pilot. I flew Uncle Sam's finest fighters for 10 years and then went back to school and got a master's in nuclear engineering.
Uh-huh.
It allowed me to work in various places like the Aerospace and Medical Division headquarters. And I ended up in the headquarters in Europe, Air Force headquarters. But that experience allowed me to retire at age 47 at the first day of 1983 with 100% of my time to do whatever I wanted to do and enough money to do it. That's the day I became a field investigator and state section director for the Mutual UFO Network. So life's just been getting more exciting ever since, and I've really enjoyed it. During those 30 years I was in college and traveling around the world Air Force bases, I found many really good UFO books all over the world in the Air Force libraries. And I find it significant that when Colonel Corso published his book called The Day After Roswell, which documents how the Army leaked into the public domain advanced technologies discovered from crashed UFOs without letting anybody know where it came from. These are technologies that couldn't be easily used for warlike purposes, but were, you know, good, successful in promoting our society. I found that book, the first order for that book at Kirtland Air Force Base was 500 copies. So somebody wants at least the military people, and I think everybody in general, to understand what's going on concerning our alien visitors. The government just doesn't want to talk about it.
Now, in your experience, are those mostly positive ideas about what the alien visitors are doing here?
I find it very positive. You know, particularly when I learned from the Rancher book, which I really didn't read until I was in my New Year's meditation for 1999, after my universe had been greatly expanded from all my other reading. I realized then that four times in our past there has been a major genetic upgrade from Homo erectus to where we are now. That is the last one being the influence of Adam and Eve here. But before that, you had the 60 on the staff that were 200,000 years ago that were told to breed with the daughters of men. Before that, you had the six colored races, and before that, Andon and Fanta. And now I recognize that we're right in the middle of another major upgrade in our genetics.
Go on.
I think that's important, and I recognize it as a joint human alien angelic project. You had a question?
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the way in which you moved from being interested in ufology, and the Rancher book. How did that take place?
Okay, starting in 1989, well, since I retired in 83, I've been going to six UFO conferences or other truth-seeking conferences around the world each year. Things like International Transpersonal Association or Institute of Noetic Sciences or something like that. And I had a shift of perspective in 89. First, I went to a conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And I saw the Rancher book on one of the book tables there, and I said, wow, that really looks interesting, and I bought it. And I put it on the bottom of my reading stack because I'm not a fast reader, and I was getting all these books from my friends who I meet at UFO conferences, and I thought I had to read those first before I met them at the next conference. And so that book was on the bottom of my stack, being used as a reference book only on rare occasions, until I was doing my New Year's meditation for 1999, and the thought came through very clearly, I need to move that book from the bottom to the top and don't read any other book until I finish it cover to cover.
Wow.
Now,
that was quite a challenge.
Yeah, it was. But I was getting 35 periodicals each month that I was, or every month or every other month that I was reading, because they were time sensitive. And that's why it took me 11 and a half months to get through that book. And I recognize that this is by far the most useful book I had ever read. I have 700 books in my learning library, and I've been holding Truth Seeker meetings in my living room on the first Saturday of each month I'm in town since 1983. But that book is by far the most important. That's why I've been buying that book by the box of 10, keeping some in my car at all times, and letting people be guided to me to get that book. You know, I'm convinced that my spirit guides talk to other people's spirit guides, or seraphim, or whatever you want to call them. And so when somebody needs a book, they're guided to me, and it's readily available. I don't give them away. I sell them for $13, because that's what it costs me, includes the DVD.
That's a really great outreach tool right there, to make sure you always have books on hand to give
right.
or to sell to people who are really interested.
Well,
and
other things happened to me in 89, in that I received 15 messages that appeared to come from a higher intelligence, not directly, but through seven other people using three different telepathic processes. And I recognize these as containing great wisdom, and so I started paying serious attention. That was the same year that, in 89, that I learned, I had a shift of perspective. I learned to perceive the universe from the perspective of my eternal soul rather than as Donald Ware.
And that was before you read the Urantia book.
That was 10 years before I read the Urantia book, yes. Because of all these other messages I was getting and all the other books I'd been reading in my search for truth. And I have not experienced the emotions of fear or anger now for 20 years. And I think that's great. And I think that shift in perspective is directly related to that overcoming fear and anger.
Now, at that time, were you, praying for that, or spiritually preparing yourself for that type of shift in perspective?
Somewhere around then, I started a spiritual practice. Actually, in 89, what I did, I wanted to know what these messages, how the public would react to them. And I was attending a Methodist church. My grandfather was a Methodist minister. And so I took a 3-page type letter and a 20-minute audio tape to my Methodist minister, and I said, I want you to tell me what you think the public reaction is going to be if I tell people what's in these messages. And he said, I can't talk to you about things I didn't learn in the seminary. It was a cop-out. He just wasn't willing to help me on that issue. And that's when I realized I need to learn more about metaphysics. Because I was, one of my jobs in the Air Force was, job titles was staff scientist, and I hadn't gotten that deeply into the spiritual aspects, but that caused me to go to the Unity Church that was teaching a course in metaphysics. And I really liked the people at Unity Church, and the ministers would speak from the pulpit in the same kind of terms they use in the Urantia book and in these other messages I was getting. They'll refer to God as universal consciousness, or even the term all that is is sometimes used, recognizing that we are divine beings. But one thing that I think is interesting is that the year after, that is in 2000, at the International UFO Congress, I use material from the Urantia book in my presentation titled UFOs and the Spiritual Hierarchy. And there were 500 people in the audience, and I asked for a show of hands at the beginning of that lecture. How many currently own or have owned a copy of the Urantia book? 52 people raised their hands. I counted them.
Wow, that's amazing.
That's 10% of that audience.
500, wow.
Yeah, but these are all truth seekers. So, you know, truth seekers are guided to the Urantia book quite often. So then I asked, how many of you have read it carefully from cover to cover? And only 6 hands remained up. That's 10% of the people who owned the book had not been able to get it through it carefully from cover to cover. And so during the week-long conference, I asked a lot of those people that lowered their hands when I asked the second question, why couldn't you get through it? And it was basically 2 reasons. First being, the concepts were just too big to get my mind around. You know, when they start talking about 7 trillion planets with intelligent life, that's a number that people can't comprehend when you're talking about dollars of the national debt, which is about what it was at that time.
Wow.
The other reason they gave me was that they understood so little of the first part of the book. It made them feel bad. And so they either put it down and picked up another book that they could understand better, or they moved on to section 4, which they could better relate to, the life of Jesus. And the main visual aid, I had 2 of them, but the main visual aid I had there was an organizational chart of Nebadon, the local universe, with the names of the headquarters and the names of the people associated. And I included how the Urantia book describes those people that are on the Council of 20 and 4 that sit there in the headquarters in Jerusalem.
Right.
And I've been a translator between cultures all my life, I think. That's one of my jobs in the Air Force as staff scientist. I headed an office called System Support. Any major command that had a biomedical problem they couldn't resolve within the command would come to me, and I would find the right scientist to solve the problem because I spoke the scientific language and
right.
I spoke the operational language. So my role now at UFO conferences is to help people understand the language so they can at least talk about that spiritual hierarchy that is represented by various alien visitors who are now assisting us in the transformation of this planet. You know, people who go to UFO conferences recognize that something big's going on, something that had never gone on this planet before. That it's a transition or a transformation. And one way I like to describe it, because people can understand it better, is throughout human history, this planet has been a third grade classroom for the soul. But it is becoming
Could you say that again? A third grade what?
A third grade classroom for the soul. You know, we are all eternal spiritual beings in our physical bodies for a reason, but we're not all here for the same reason. Most people are here to use free will to make choices that polarize their souls toward service to others or service to self.
Very good point.
Once you get sufficiently polarized one way or the other, you're ready to graduate to the next level in the evolution of the soul. You know, everything evolves. I think truth seekers recognize that. Even the human spirit evolves through many steps, according to the Urantia book, on our long path to paradise. But when you orient yourself through your own free will choices sufficiently to become ready to learn to express unconditional love of others, then you become what we call a fourth density citizen, ready for the fourth grade. Well, it is a joint human, alien, angelic program to transform planet Earth from a third grade classroom for the soul to a fourth grade classroom for the soul.
And is this sort of a common idea among ufologists?
I think it is, where everybody is here to learn to express unconditional love of others. And the capability of the human changes along the way, because that's impossible to do if there are too many really highly selfish people living on the same planet with us. Because
now,
we become more telepathic. We learned how to read the minds of other people. We're doing it right now in many different ways.
I have a question for you about the about that presentation, the one that you said you had only 10% who were able to get through the book. I would like, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm fascinated with that, would like to hear more about how you got the information from them. Did you interview them after your speech or during the speech? Was it an interactive kind of program?
Well, I've been on the board of the International UFO Congress since 1993, and the same people, the same 500 people or so, come back to the conference each year, or 700 or 800 sometimes, and it's a week-long conference. I'm usually gone. I'm there the day before and the day after, so I'm there 9 days, and you get to know these people pretty well. So I had a lot of interaction with the people all during the week when I asked them these questions.
You had said that you had asked them basically, you've determined that the two main reasons they weren't able to get through the book were that,
right,
initially the concepts
too big to get their mind around.
Too big to get their mind around,
yeah.
And then the other one was that they would get bogged down early on in the book, and it would just
make them
feel bad.
Yeah, I think that's probably an ego thing. If they're struggling to read this thing, and it made them feel bad because they just couldn't quite understand what that paragraph was saying. Now,
was your recommendation to them? I mean,
my recommendation was, don't worry about not understanding it. Force your way through those first 300 pages. That first 100 pages on a detailed description of divinity, and the next on the various beings created in paradise to manage the various structures of the grand universe. And you will absorb enough to appreciate the rest of the book, to appreciate the life of Jesus when you get there. But if you start with section 4, I don't think you'll get as much appreciation for his life than if you started at the beginning.
That's a really good point. We have another caller on the air. Let's invite him in, or her in. Hold on a moment.
Okay.
Hi, 303, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. This is Chris Halverson.
Hi,
hello,
Chris.
I've heard a lot about you.
nice to finally hear you talk a little bit here. I've been listening since you started.
Good.
Yeah, I was just I'll just chime in on that last thing that was being brought up there, that the idea that to encourage people to read through the first parts, even if they don't understand a lot of it initially, but it slowly percolates in and it grows. And even the first time through, by the time you get to the Jesus papers, you'll have a little bit bigger context in mind. So it isn't such a localized story of just some person who mysteriously came to planet Earth, and you don't really know why or how it fits into the big picture.
Absolutely. Chris, we just finished last month our Your Rancher book study group here. It took us 7 years to get through the book in the study group. And now we've started, last week we started a new study group, and I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot more the second time through it, even though I've been through the book twice already.
Yeah, it you know, in the group that I lead, we're just working on it. We're working through the first three parts of the book for the second time, and I don't know, we started back in like 95 or something like that, a long time ago.
Right.
So it takes a long time.
Well, I was the host for Halbert when Halbert Katzen, when he came through here, and I think it's good to use different avenues, like, you know, the scientific perspective, to get people interested who may not be going to truth seeker groups like I do. When we when I read the book, I started encouraging people in the truth seeker group that meets in my living room every first Saturday of each month to start a You Answer Book study group. And it took 3 years before a retired Army two-star general offered his home and his lovely younger German wife to host these things. And then it bounced around between their house and my house and several other people during those 7 years. But it was a great experience, and I really think there ought to be a You Answer Book study group in every you know, available to everybody on the planet somehow.
I guess what I was just thinking, one of the thoughts I had as I was listening to you, are there a number of venues that you have spoken about the Rancher book, or is it just at that one big conference, annual conference?
That was the first time, yes. I speak about it. I go to six conferences a year and often have an opportunity to comment about it, if not from the podium, from, you know, in speaking personally to the people.
Mm-hmm.
We have a regional organization called Unlimited Horizons that brings in monthly speakers to the Gulf Coast of Florida. And we have the book available at each of our monthly meetings for those people that attend those speaker forums. Again, we have to sell them for $15 there because they require 10% on all books sold at that forum. But, yeah, a lot of the books have been picked up there.
So you have found a lot of interest. Do you find there's a broad diversity of kind of initial starting points that people have that gives them an initial interest or curiosity about the book, or you know, what's
you
the
know,
general
I think
character
it's,
of that?
I think it's people whose seraphim have kind of guided them to be truth seekers. One of the more interesting sales I had was I was in Franklin, North Carolina, and with my son, we were just looking through the local small bookstore, and I saw a book on the ivory-billed woodpecker, and I'm one of the few people who has been able to find the ivory-billed woodpecker since people thought it went extinct 50 years
mm-hmm.
ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I bought the book. It was about, you know, ivory-billed research over the years. And when I paid for it, I told, you know, it was like $26. And I said, you know, I have in my trunk the best book ever written, and it only costs half this much. And he said, I want to see that book. And I took it out and opened the trunk, and I showed it to him, and he says, wow. I said, $13, and he handed it over. So there are all kinds of ways you can get the book into people's hands that need it.
And
well,
would
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I also want to tell you we've got another caller waiting, so I want to get to that person in a minute, but I wanted to ask you, Don, since you started introducing people to the book through the UFO community, it seems to me you've also just started introducing the book to almost everyone you can in all sorts of different situations. Is that correct?
Well, as I said, I've probably sold 9 boxes at least out of the trunk of my car. That's, 90 books, and you know, wherever I am, whether I'm at a I'm on the board of the Alabama Ornithological Society. If I happen to be in discussions there with people that I recognize as truth seekers, I'll tell them about the book. And often they'll be interested enough to buy it.
Well, let's take the next caller we have. Hold on just a second.
Hold on.
805, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I'm just calling in to listen. I think I'll just listen for a while.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
Okay, let me tell you a little bit about an interesting thing that happened to me in 2000. I was, I think my spirit guides intervened here to get me an invitation to the sixth and last State of the World Forum. And what happened, our world leaders decided to hold six meetings with leaders of the world to try to define the type of planet we want to live on in the 21st century. They started at the Fremont Hotel in San Francisco, limited to 500 people. But in 2000, for the last one, they moved it to the New York Hilton and held it in conjunction with the UN Millennium Summit. And they handled 1,500 people there, so they were able to invite 1,000 more people. And I told one of my birding friends when I was up at Attu Island, Alaska, that I was interested in these forums because I'm a student of world government. And he said, yeah, he was kind of interested in world government too, but he'd never heard of the State of the World Forum. And when he got back home, there was an invitation for him to attend the State of the World Forum in New York. And
wow.
he couldn't go, and so he put it in the mail to me and said, why don't you go in my stead? And I did. And that allowed me to participate in a round table, 35 people, on democratizing world governance, on getting more spirituality into the United Nations. And it allowed me to put a web page on my own web page on the exclusive State of the World Forum website, only accessible to the people that came to those six meetings, which includes all the heads of state, essentially. And I must have put something on there that got the attention of the president, State of the World Forum, because he called me about a year later. Or his vice president called me and says that he wanted to talk to me. And we had to set up an appointment in the future, and she called at that time about 3 weeks later and said, unfortunately got called out of town, but she we had a good email conversation going on after that, and I was sending her some of the papers I was getting. And when I did talk to him on the telephone, I asked him if he'd read the Urantia book. I knew that he had been educated at Princeton and Harvard, and is recognized as one of the world's best organizers, and his response shocked me. He says, yes, I read that when I was in college.
Oh, wow.
So, and he did have, Manly P. Hall's book on his coffee table, Secret Teachings of All Ages, which I think was written in 1928 by one of the biggest, smartest truth seekers on the planet. So it's nice to, and also that led to me being invited to a conference at the European Parliament in 2003 titled National Sovereignty and Universal Challenges, Choices for the World After Iraq. And I think the reason I was invited is because he recognized that my world is really big. As a truth seeker for 57 years and, studying the Urantia book and all that, he thought that my perspective on those major issues, world issues, would be useful. I was invited to both of those conferences as director of the International UFO Congress, which gives some credibility to this area that some people call fringe.
And what is it about the Urantia book, do you think, that appeals to people in that quote-unquote supposed fringe?
Oh, it just answers so many questions. I think religions exist actually, my view on religions is that many times higher intelligence comes here to teach us about the reality of the universe, and we humans turn it into some kind of a religion. And that religion gets distorted over time. I'm really thankful for the Urantia Foundation to keep this Urantia book from getting distorted like the Bible was. But over time, for various reasons, some intentional, it gets distorted. And so they have to come down and give us an update, something more correct and something a little bigger, as the human mind is capable of absorbing more information. We are given more information. I really think this Urantia book is going to be a primary text for people on this planet for the next 100 years or more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're all in agreement on that. What do you think, Chris?
The question you just asked, Kristalyn, is basically the question that I was wanting to ask. And I'll just follow up on that. I'm curious about, like Kristalyn said, the people who are coming out of the UFO community who you've gotten interested in the book, have you found that there's some specific kind of real question that they've had as they've studied UFOs and they weren't finding any way to resolve that question, but, you know, having the Urantia book, now they understand how it fits in, or, you know, what the answer to their question is. Have you found something specific like that, that the Urantia book is answering, that they're really not able to answer outside of the Urantia book?
Well, you know, the assessment of myself and most of the local truth seekers here, I think, is that because of the main event taking place on the planet right now, there was a rule when this book was given to us not to talk in detail about our alien visitors. And I think that was a very wise decision. So what I did in my lecture out in Nevada is I took the personal stories of interactions between people I know and who are, you know, spiritually oriented, truth-seeking people, and various different types of alien folks, Pleiadians, those from Zeta Reticula, and just a bunch of different Aldebaran. They're the scientists that helped us in some technology events, and from UMO, just a lot of different places, Arcturians who are concerned about what we're doing to the planet, trying to help there. And I understand why these questions or why these subjects are not in the Urantia book. One, probably because there weren't a whole lot of questions from Dr. Sadler's Truth Seeker group about UFOs at the time. But I think there's been a moratorium on certain information coming into the planet that might be harmful. So that may be another reason why they didn't talk about it there. But it's okay, you know, that as things speed up, it's okay to talk about a wider range of these subjects. Now, the only problem...
I was just going to interject and say, are you saying that one of the things that they're really appreciate about the Urantia book is it gives them that bigger context in which to think about their experiences or the things that they're studying about, you know, in regard to UFOs? Do you think that's the main thing?
It expands their universe.
Yeah.
As we go from a third grade classroom for the soul to a fourth grade classroom for the soul, we're going to be exposed to so much more information. We need what we're getting because of our interaction with the Zetas in particular, which is a bigger hard drive, a faster chip, and a new USB port for telepathy. You know, aliens speak to each other through direct projection of thought, and they speak to human beings through direct projection of thought. As we join their society, as we are allowed to join their society through our own free will choices, then we have to be able to communicate with them. It's all part of the big plan. You know, my spiritual practice involves the Triangles program, part of the Lucis Trust. If you go to lucistrust.org, you can read that's one of the nine branches. And for the audience, I'd like to repeat the great invocation, if you don't mind. It's something that I think it's important for a lot of people to do, for the purpose of raising the vibratory level of human consciousness, the sea of consciousness we all live in, because other people's minds tend to tune in more to that vibratory level if more people do this. That's why they call it the Triangles program. You're invited to be in one triangle, and you're invited to invite two other people to be in a triangle. But it says, and you go into a slightly meditative state through this, connect your mind with the other two people in your triangle and say, from the point of light in the mind of God, let light stream forth into human minds. Let light descend on earth. And when I speak of the term light, I think truth and wisdom. From the point of love in the heart of God, let love stream forth into human hearts. May the coming one return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose enter all little human wills, the purpose that the masters know and serve. From the center which is called the human race, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. And the bottom line is, let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. And I think one way to describe the plan is the transformation of the planet to a fourth grade classroom for the soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess one of the things that I've heard other Urantia Book readers express is this sense that the Urantia Book, you know, has to be part of a much bigger picture.
Yes.
Of sort of reawakening the planet to the real nature of the universe in which we live. And, you know, we're not supposed to be as ignorant and isolated as we have been for so long.
Yeah. I have one little paper. I've written a whole bunch of papers, and I'll tell you where you can read them if you want, but one of them is called Spiritual Assistance. Or no, Celestial Assistance is the title of it. But it describes a number of personal experiences that I've had over the years. For example, in 1992, I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning with a video screen in my mind that had two sentences written on it. There was no room in my mind for any other thought until I got up and wrote down what was on those two sentences. And the first one said, unconditional love is becoming the driving force on this planet. And the second said, I am trying to learn to express unconditional love. Now, that was the first time that I started to think that I might be part of that fourth grade classroom for the soul. In 1996, I was at an Institute of Noetic Sciences conference, and I was trying to take notes at Joan Borisenko's lecture. I have my yellow pad in front of me, and I like to take detailed notes when I hear a new speaker. 5 minutes into that, I flipped the pad over, and I wrote natural science, followed by 12 lines. Let me read you these. They're short. God is all that is. God is love and light. Light, or energy, can be condensed to form quarks. Quarks combine to form protons and neutrons. Protons and neutrons are glued together to form atoms. Atoms combine electromagnetically to form molecules. Molecules combine, accumulate, and grow to form living bodies for the spirit, for the love of God. It's kind of a full circle thing. The terminology is part of, you know, my mind because of my master's is in nuclear engineering. But I know I had help in writing that poem. I've had no desire to ever write poetry before or since. I think because I dedicated so much of my life to studying telepathic communications, the great classics that were written in the English language, like the Urantia book, The Keys of Enoch, The Raw Material, The Course of Miracles, etc., then I was given a demonstration how it works.
We have another caller on the air, Don.
Okay.
805, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. This is Dr. Dave calling in.
Hi, Dr. Dave.
Hi, Crystalline. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Hi, Mr. Ware. How you doing?
Great, thank you.
We met at UCLA at the IC this summer. We had a chance to discuss. I study UFOs a little bit myself, and I think it's, you know, it's funny because people see things through their own lens, you know. And like I was talking with some readers recently that are gay, and they think that the major split, you know, among the Urantia readers is between readers that are gay and readers that are straight. And I've hung out with UFO people, and they think the main split in the readership is between people that, you know, see connections to UFOs and the information in the Urantia book about, you know, celestial visitors and possibly other mortal visitors from other planets. And I guess the point of all this is that no matter how we look at the book, I think it's important that we, you know, differentiate how we interpret the book from the actual information in the book, especially when we're, you know, when we're talking to potentially people that know nothing about the book for the first time. And Mr. Ware, I just noticed that a couple of things that you said kind of mixed some information. One of them that really caught my ear when I first tuned in was that you said that you thought the book says something about keeping information about alien visitors on the planet some sort of, you know, secret, and that's in the Urantia book. Do you feel that's in the Urantia book?
Well, there is an awful lot of interaction between those people from which some of us call higher intelligence from off-planet. Some are in physical bodies and some aren't. And if you're communicating with an unseen being that's in a physical body that doesn't look human, we tend to call it alien. If it doesn't have a physical body, we often call them angels. But
you're talking about mortals that aren't readers of the book. Just how they kind of, I mean, any reader of the book would know about seven classifications of conscious being, and you know, mortal being the lowest, and all that. And we wouldn't really talk about just angels and devils. I mean, I don't think, right?
Right. I've been taught in the raw material, for example, that good and bad are not really useful words, that positive and negative or selfish and unselfish are words we ought to use instead, because everything is relative.
Well, everything is not relative. We know that good is not relative. We know from the Urantia book that one of the great mistakes that Adam and Eve made was using the dualism and the dualistic nature of mankind to tie the concept of evil to the, you know, to the concept of good. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, you got to have evil to have good, but we know, being Urantia book readers, that is absolutely not true, that the good exists independent of the bad, and that Adam and Eve made a mistake tying the concept for humans to kind of advance things. I mean, maybe they were even persuaded to do so by Caligastia or Lucifer, who knows? We don't get that information, but we know that they tied evil to good. But that's not necessary. The good exists. It's a white background with black splotches and not the other way around, right?
I agree.
So I'm just curious, like, when you're talking to UFO groups, for instance, and you mentioned the Urantia book, like, are you careful to state, you know, this is from the Urantia book and this is my own opinion? I mean, for instance, I know you're a member of UBRON also, because I see your name pop up on there sometimes. Yeah. And you
well,
know,
I was a member of MUFON. I'm a member of the International UFO Congress now.
Oh, well, you know, it's like it's like being Catholic. They get you from birth and then they never let you go.
I worked for them diligently for 10 years, yes.
Well, the point is that whenever this discussion about UFOs comes up, inevitably, some people that, you know, don't really believe that the UFOs have anything to do with the Urantia book, they get upset at people for, you know, t- talking about things as if the Urantia book talks about UFOs, and I don't know. I just, when you said that the Urantia, I specifically, it was the line you said that the Urantia book says something about keeping it, on the hush that there are celestial visitors, and I just, from my reading of the Urantia book, I've never really seen what you're referring to when you say that.
Well, perhaps that was a misinterpretation of what I was saying. I think they have good reason for not addressing the issue of people seeing UFOs. In my UFO studies, I recognize that the main reason people see UFOs is because they're involved in the current hybridization program.
And hybridization?
Hybridization. The world government's lawyer told me, I've seen him on two occasions, I've seen him give two lectures. This is a fellow named George S. Robinson. He told me that we humans have already made a new subspecies and a new species called Homo alterius spatialis. We did it to make us more survivable on off-planet conditions. He was not allowed to mention the word alien anywhere. Everybody in the room knew that it's a joint human-alien project. And
are you talking about conscious beings? I mean, are you?
I'm talking about
beings that we allegedly are creating have some sort of consciousness comparable to humans.
I know 90 some people very well who've been on board alien vehicles many times, and every one of them is involved in the hybridization program. We're getting from our Zeta Reticulan friends a bigger hard drive, a faster chip, and a new USB port for telepathy. Now, our world leaders put on the cover of Time magazine what our hybrid offspring looks like on 23 June 97. They call it Homo alterius spatialis. So if anybody
I'm going to have to interrupt right now and just say that we've got a bunch of different callers on the line now, and we've only got 8 minutes left of this hour. And I want to get to the topic of the show, which is introducing the book to people within that community. And I think we have talked about that a bit, but I'd like to further that a little more. But let's see what caller 320 has to ask. Hold on.
Okay.
Hi, 320, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Christina Seaborn. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Now, in all these different experiences that you've had, have you actually been on board an alien vehicle? Have you actually met beings from other planets? Have you had personal experience with that?
I have not, but I have a friend named Yvonne who lives nearby, and she has physically had an alien being appear in her bedroom. She got on her knees, gave him a hug, took him by the hand, and gave him a tour of the house. And this fellow named Theo has offered to answer any of my questions. So not only do I get information from someone who uses the name Adam through these two ladies in North Carolina that send me lots of tasking messages, but I have another independent source. In fact, I have several sources. There are leftover, more spiritually oriented leftovers from the Atlantean civilization that still live on this planet who answer my questions when I ask. So that's kind of exciting. For example, some of the tasking I've been getting has caused me to send a letter to Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer of ABC to help prepare them for the day when they will have to address to the general public the alien presence. It took me a year to get that done, but I was told by Adam that I would do that before I wrote the book I was inspired to write called The Rising Culture Joining a Galactic Society. And I did, and now I don't need to write that book anymore because I've got a new website that has 15 of my papers on it that kind of takes the place of the book. So if you want to copy down this web address, it's www.freewebs.com donware, D-O-N-W-A-R-E. You can see the results of my studies over the past 15 years, including all of my personal experiences. I was asked to read the book called Bible Code 2. After I read it, I got another message from the same source that said, now write a letter to this VIP, and I won't name the VIP, to encourage them to be instrumental in uncovering the key to the Bible codes. Apparently those, if you're not familiar with the Bible codes, those first five books of the Torah were given in such a way that when we develop computers and you put those characters without any punctuation in it, and then you ask, you search for sentences, you know, using every other word or vertical or horizontal, diagonal or whatever, every other letter, I mean, it has lots of messages that pertain to what's spoken about on that page. But these are predictions. It's to let people know that the source of those first five books of the Bible came from people who were very smart and knew at the time when we developed computers, we'd get a lot more information from them.
So, Chris, do you have any other questions for Don before our next guest comes on the air? He's actually waiting to get on now. So,
thank you. My question's been answered. Go ahead with the next caller.
You have another question, Christina?
I just said thank you, and go ahead with the next caller.
You're welcome.
Okay. All right. Hi, 850, you're on the air.
Good morning. This is Arnie Ondas holding.
Hi, Arnie. Well, I just wanted to introduce you in a moment, but I want to ask Chris if he has any last questions for Don before we bring you on.
Thank you.
Chris, are you still on the air?
Yes, I'm still here. And I'm sorry, I thought you were actually asking me just a second ago. But I don't think I really have any other questions that are pressing at the moment. The main thing I was really curious about, and you know, maybe you could just say a little bit more about that, Don, is what kind of ongoing sort of sustained relationship with the Rashi book that you've cultivated and a number of these readers, you know, when you get people going on reading the book, coming out of the UFO community, are you finding that they're staying with it? You know, is it something that sort of is they only hold on to for a while and then they move on?
A lot of them stay with it, Chris, but there are certain hot button issues in that book. For example, there's a statement in there talking about six colored races and refers to some as primary and some secondary. And that puts off people when you talk about, you know, secondary races because of it's not politically correct. So I tell people that they must maintain a large mental whole basket when they read this book. In other words, that's a term I got from my Air Force experience. Anybody with a desk job has three baskets on the corner of their desk. Your secretary puts the stuff coming in the bottom one, the in basket. If you don't finish what you need to do with it that day, then you put it in the whole basket in the middle. If you've just signed it and it's ready to go, then you accept it, then you put it in the out box. But if you read the book with a large mental whole basket, the biggest hot-button issue has been some statements in there on reincarnation. And reincarnation was the personal reality of everybody in our Truth Seeker group. There are 150 people on our Truth Seeker list here. And, you know, 25 to 40 of them meet in my living room every month. And everybody knows that reincarnation is a part of reality.
So,
nothing makes
so
sense.
You really find, you find that these same difficult issues that you know people experience in general in bringing in new readers—it's not really that different, you know, in this sort of subset of people.
Yeah.
The same sort of difficult things, like with the races, and
right.
So that's interesting. That.
But there's so much good, valuable stuff in the book. Don't let any specific issue like that turn you off from the book. That's what I want to encourage everybody to do.
Well, on that note, I would like to introduce you all to Arnie Ondas. He's also from Florida, from the Fort Worth, great, now I can't remember, Gulf Breeze, Florida, right, Arnie?
That's correct, yes.
And he's an executive in the healthcare industry and has been involved in, as a truth seeker and spiritual healer and worker for many years. And I have heard that he has had some remarkable success in introducing people of the from the metaphysical and spiritual healers groups to the Urantia book. And I'd like to welcome Arnie on the air this morning. Hi, Arnie.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about your background and how you became familiar with the book?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to. Well, I guess I started out as a good Catholic school boy and went to Catholic schools for 12 years. And for many reasons, that didn't quite work for me, which was a good thing because it led me to search. And I was searching without ever really realizing it. Then when I was 19 years old, I had the good fortune of meeting a wonderful person who became my first spiritual mentor. And this person opened me spiritually, I guess is the only way I could put it. And I studied many, many things under her leadership. Some things would be familiar to people in the audience, Silver Mind Control, the Alice Bailey Arcane School teachings, just a number of other things, and did quite a few things metaphysically, got involved with energy transfer, with healing, with things that would be considered paranormal. And then one day when I was 20 years old, she said, Arnie, you've got to see this. Someone had given her the Urantia book, and she started reading it to me and said, this is it. This, just listen to this. This has so much truth together in one place. And she had always taught me that that there's truth in all things, and if you're truly a truth seeker, then you will recognize the truth but continue looking beyond that for a deeper truth, for absolute truth, truth with a capital T, as she used to call it. And she advised me in the early days before we got the book for me not to get carried away with the phenomena of whatever it was I was experiencing, whether it was something to do with clairvoyance or something to do with out-of-body travel, which I'm not so sure is anything more than working with consciousness. But she kept saying, go beyond that, go deeper, find the truth and find God and continue to follow that. So the book came along and we studied the book, and then it was time for me to go off to college, and I had the book for many, many years and would kind of go back to it from time to time, but I was a young person. I got involved in some things I probably should not have, and got involved in school, starting a career, and so forth. But this book was something that I continued to go back to, and I'd read it for a while, and sometimes it would just sit on the shelf. But I would always go back to it, or I would come across some other teaching or some other way of looking at reality, and it would bring me mentally back to what the Urantia book said about it. So it became my touchstone. And then as time went on and I matured, I became a serious student of the book, and that's been for several years. So that's kind of my background with the book, and I guess I've been involved in bringing people to the book all of these years. I was 20 years old, 37 years ago, so I've given a lot of books away over the years, talked with countless people about it, but it's really only been recently, in the last several years, that I've had a very pointed or focused approach to bringing the book to other people.
And what initiated that for you?
Well, I think that I think, maturing, for one thing. But also, there are kind of two guiding principles or philosophies, maybe, that guide me. And the first thing is that I think of the parable of the talents, and the question being, what have you done with what you've been given? And I know that I will have to account for that one day. And so I want to always be out there in doing something with what I've been given. You know, I've reached the point in life where I can look back. And as I look back, I see many things, many missed opportunities, many opportunities taken, but many opportunities missed. And the greatest, I think, regrets in my life have been over those opportunities that were missed. You know, if why didn't I say this?
Right.
Why didn't I do that? If I had said this, this person would have had a different outcome. So I want to, looking ahead, I don't want to live with regret. I want to take every opportunity that I can and do something with it. And the second, I think, guiding principle is that several years ago, I came to a point where there was no other place for me to go, no other growth for me to achieve. It was kind of an end of the road where I had no other place to go except to consecrate my will to that of our fathers. And, you know, I think that sounds trite, but I think the difference is that although I think in many times in my life I had done that, it wasn't the same quality. It wasn't the same degree of it. It wasn't the same, this is not a good word for it, but it wasn't with the same absoluteness of it. And there was no place for me to go except there. And I say that, but it wasn't a thing of desperation. It was just that, you know, Arnie, it's time to just do what you believe. And there's no other meaning to life except for this. And so having done that, and I think that there may be people listening that maybe understand what I'm trying to communicate about this, but because of that, which was a real turning point a few years ago, now I expect things to happen.
It's kind of a consecration of choice or consecration of will, I think, that really moves you into that place.
Yes, it was. But, you know, in the past I had always thought that I was doing that, but it wasn't until this last time did I really understand what it meant to consecrate our will to the Father's. But because of that, you know, I expect to be used as a tool for His will to work out in this world. So I expect others to be brought to me, to be put in my path. And I know that as a result of this, I have to be God in the world. I have to do what He can't. So I have to assume that every person that I come across every day throughout my daily life is there for a reason. And I just can't disregard people. I have to try to discern if there's something that I need to say or do to that person on behalf of God.
Well,
so those are kind of
beautiful sentiment and beautiful idea.
Well, that's kind of where it brought me to, and I think that, you know, these two guiding ideas or values or philosophies or whatever really is kind of what keeps me going, and that's what's worked for me.
I noticed that you had sent out a, an overview of some of the things that you talk about when you are talking to the groups that you're invited to speak with. And actually, perhaps I should ask you to tell us about that before I ask you to tell you about that values sheet that you shared with me, which I thought was wonderful. Tell us a little bit about some of the speaking engagements you've had and some of the opportunities you've had to do outreach to large groups.
Well, I would have to say that most of my outreach has been to individuals, or very small groups of people, and this was actually the first year where we're working together with my friends and my thought adjuster, with my angel, with all of these things that could work together, brought me to have this wonderful opportunity to be in contact with really almost 1,000 people at the 7th annual Emerald Coast Metaphysical Festival. So that was really my first foray into it, and also at that time had become a featured speaker for this festival, and that was my first, after all of these years, believe it or not, that was my first experience with talking with a large group of people about the Urantia book.
And what was the topic of your talk?
Well, I'm aware that many people have been listening to Don Ware, who spoke ahead of me, and this group that sponsored the Metaphysical Festival is Unlimited Horizons. And Don had mentioned that when he was speaking this morning, because it was the outgrowth of the MUFON chapter that developed here in our part of Florida. And so it was this Unlimited Horizons group that that does this once a year. And so
the name of the event is the Metaphysical...
The Emerald Coast Metaphysical Festival.
Metaphysical Festival, okay.
Yes. So that brings all kinds of people with all kinds of interests, and it's just a very interesting mix of people, and it's a wonderful fertile field for talking with people about the book. I don't know if I answered your question, Crystalyn.
Well, I just wanted to know what the topic you were, you said that you were asked to speak to this group, and I wondered what, you know, like if somebody was coming to your lecture, to your presentation, what was the name of the presentation? What was the title of the presentation?
The title was The Urantia Book, Compelling Evidence of ET Contact. And so...
Compelling Evidence of ET Contact?
Yes, extraterrestrial contact. And
okay.
So, and as we know, the whole book is from extraterrestrial contact. If we expand our semantics, and if we expand our understanding of the words, extraterrestrial would be any being that is not of earthly origin.
Right.
So that was the topic, and I also got to speak about, in the process of talking about ET contact with the Urantia book, I got to talk about the book, I got to talk about so many different things related to the Urantia book that I think that many people in the audience were hearing about it for the first time and became interested in the book itself, and several books were sold afterwards. So, and it was just a matter of understanding who my audience was that I would take that kind of approach. I've been asked to speak at another metaphysical festival in Pensacola coming up this fall, and probably I'll speak about something maybe like the Urantia book and the Law of Attraction, because so many people are interested in the so-called secret and the Law of Attraction, and kind of bring in about the Urantia book, and what does the Urantia book have to say about the Law of Attraction, and so forth. And it's just grabbing people where they are.
Exactly. I think that's a very important point, and one that there's been some discussion with on the chat room this morning, but just about how the book really does tend to take people where they are and add to whatever level of spiritual growth they're currently working on, and sort of moving them to the next level. And there was comment that came up at study group this last week about, you know, whether the Urantia book was here to leaven the world's religions, and or whether or not the Urantia book was here to leaven the spiritual experience of religionists. And I think that was a very interesting differentiation.
Yeah. Did anyone talk about why can't it be both?
I think we did, because there were definitely some people there who felt like, you know, it was here to sort of take Christianity to the next level, or to take Judaism to the next level. And the individual who brought the topic up was someone who didn't believe that that was the case,
mm-hmm.
and was uncomfortable with that idea. There were some people in the group who were more of that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think Chris is still on the air. He was at that group. What did you think, Chris?
Yes, I am still on the air. Hello, Arnie. Nice to kind of meet you indirectly here.
Yeah,
Chris Halverson is on the air.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've
met. I've heard a lot of good things about Chris.
Well, thank you. Let's see. I think you're right, Crystal, and there are people who could see it both ways on the issue of what exactly it's meant to uplift. And I reminded everyone to not forget that unlike the fourth ethical revelation, the fifth is foreshadowing the next dispensational visit, which is focused on mindal upliftment as opposed to spiritual upliftment that Jesus was focused on. You know, the magisterial son, is normally after the material upliftment of Adam and Eve comes mindal upliftment through the magisterial son, and then spiritual upliftment through the bestowal son. So, it's a much broader philosophical perspective that's coming into play. So it definitely goes beyond just augmenting religions. It's about uplifting the whole philosophical context of mankind.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying it's really augmenting the way we think, not necessarily just what we think.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who have been spiritually awakened, and they now need help with the bigger context in which to apply that spiritual consciousness. In other words, weaving that spiritual consciousness into the world around you so that you can begin to awaken your greater consciousness, your cosmic consciousness, you know, which is has a warp and a woof. It's not just one set of fibers. I was interested in Arnie, what you were saying about how you finally reached that point, and you were struggling for a word. I think you said absoluteness, or sort of
yeah.
choice. I think maybe wholeheartedness is maybe.
Maybe that's
the word,
yes. Maybe that's
the word you were looking for.
Yeah,
yeah, and I've heard other people talk about that in their journey. You know, they for many years they kept telling themselves they were making wholehearted choices, but it didn't seem to be getting them anywhere. And
yeah.
finally, at
yeah.
some point, they realized that they hadn't been making wholehearted choices. They'd been making half-hearted choices.
Right.
And when they finally made that wholehearted choice, then indeed things changed in their life.
Yes, yes. It's a whole different quality.
Yeah. And,
I think it's very interesting. My own experience with that has been very similar. You know, I always thought I was making wholehearted choices, but I think that there is a point to the statement made in the Urantia book, you know, that a pint can't hold a quart.
Oh, yes.
And there is a certain aspect of emotional and spiritual maturity or maturation, that maturation process that we go through, that involves making quite a few mistakes along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that half-heartedness, I mean, in my own experience, I didn't feel half-hearted. I didn't know that I wasn't fully committed.
Right.
But what I realized later on was that it was an issue of focus, you know, that my focus was scattered. I was trying to do 10 things at once. And my father pointed this out to me. He said, when you're doing 10 or 15 things all at the same time, and you come up against, you know, a colossal failure result, you don't know which one of those things resulted in that failure. You know, and one of the benefits of being really focused is that you sort of know what the consequences are of those choices very clearly. And I find now that I'm becoming more unifocused or more consecrated, more whole. I'm able to be more wholehearted because I know what that choice is. I don't know. I'm kind of not being very articulate there, but I hope maybe one of you or all of you know what I'm talking about.
It's such a personal thing. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to hold up one of the other things you were saying that I thought was excellent, and like you testified, you've gotten to the point now where you really can step back and see things more objectively and clearly, and make more wholehearted choices. And in the process, when you approach others, you're able to do it much more like Jesus did, of recognizing where they are and gently engaging them there, and guiding those those young shoots upward.
I hope so. Yes.
Yeah, and their growth, and I think that's a perspective that is really worthy of helping others to appreciate that. You know, and those of us who feel like we've kind of gotten more to that point where we begin to have that as a natural sense, you know, to encourage others towards that too. That graciousness of engagement that Jesus had.
Yes.
It was always so not only amazing but effective.
Well, and that brings up another point that I wanted to ask Arnie about, that sort of graciousness. You were talking with me earlier on the phone about how it is that you find where people are and try to reach them with an experience that's meaningful to them, then to bring that around to a sort of a universal truth. Maybe you'd like to talk a bit about that, how you've done that in your presentation.
I'd be glad to, and if I go off on a tangent, please reel me back in, okay? I guess really I would have to start with going back to that first mentor that I had many years ago when I was young, who told me that there was truth in all things. And I believe that in all my heart. I think that, to me, obviously, I'm a dedicated student of the Your Answer book, and there is no other source on this planet of truth that is as replete as that book is. But when I talk about truth with groups, I have a crystal paperweight that's in the form of a diamond. And I like to use that kind of as a physical metaphor talking about truth, because there is truth in whatever a person is interested in whatever spiritual path they happen to be walking. But I use the diamond to show them that what they're seeing is an incomplete part of the truth. That they're seeing a reflection of light through one of the facets of that diamond, but it's only through one of the facets, which means that it's not complete, and that so they have to understand what the truth is in their path, and then also to look beyond that and see what the greater truth is. And I also used the diamond to show that, to me, the Rancer book is the diamond, that contains more truth than anything else that there is. But at the same point, we have to recognize that even that's not enough, because we have to use that to go beyond what it says to find the truth ourselves. And I think the example there is that even though that diamond, that your answer book, contains so much truth, it's being refracted as light, it's still not the source of light. So we even have to go beyond that to the source of light. But anyway, using the diamond, talking about honoring whatever path of truth that a person is on, I think is one of the first steps in meeting a person where he or she is. One of the values that I learned in all of this is, don't be judgmental. You know, this is, even though my background 35 years ago was in metaphysics, I can walk into a metaphysical festival such as the one we're discussing, and even though I understand all of that, it's still very foreign to me because I've been so Urantian in my focus and outlook for so many years. But I think that it would have been easy for me, as I've done in previous years, to just kind of dismiss all of that and say, this is all just part of the isms and cults of the philosophically confused generation. And, that may be the truth, or that's certainly part of the truth. But for me to have made that judgment would have been just a gross error, because then it would not have, I would have been closed off to them and to their truth and would not have been able to interact with these folks where they are.
Right, and find that common ground where you can connect.
Exactly. For example, I listen to everyone that I could possibly listen to, anyone who came by my booth. I had to remind myself that I was being a herald of truth and not a steamroller. And I think that over the years, I've made the mistake of trying to introduce the book to other people by giving a dissertation on the book. And it sounded very scholarly, and it sounded right to me. They had no idea what I was talking about. So I asked them things like, well, what brings you to the festival? What are your interests? With my background in metaphysics, I can speak that language. I know exactly what they're talking about when they answer that question. And I can take that interest and bring in concepts from the Your Answer book, and try to help them become motivated to learn more about that, and to learn more greater truth with a capital T.
Sorry, I was going to ask you, can you give us some examples of might go?
Sure. Someone might say that they're interested in angels. And so that might lead me to talk with them about angels and some of the functions of angels and why angels are so important to us in our daily life. Someone may be interested in life after death. I can think of one person who came to me and she was mourning the death of her son. And, that allowed me to talk about, progressive evolution and the mansion worlds and how we go on and where we go and the hope in all of that. The same thing with, people are interested in evolution or in reincarnation. You can just take that and redirect it into teachings of the book in such a way that it's interesting to them. I think that, but to go back to your original question about graciousness, I realized that I was there among many vendors, and I felt that I was the agent of a friendly universe of a loving and generous God, and that being true, then I had to embody all of that grace and all of that generosity. So what that meant to me was that every single person who came to my booth got something. You know, whether it was just a simple personal acknowledgement, looking them in the eyes, or giving them free handouts that Paula Thompson had given me from the fellowship. Whatever it was, they got something. And I think that I felt that I was just full of cosmic energy. It's the only way I can explain it. So therefore, I touched as many people as I possibly could. I shook as many hands as I possibly could. I just planted as many seeds as I possibly could, but everybody gets something. And I think that that's really important when we go out there and we're trying to bring this revelation to other people that we interact with.
Absolutely. Well, and you had said, too, that there are a lot of spiritual healers who are at these events.
Yes.
And that was sort of a special niche market, if you would, or subgroup of people that you found very receptive to the Arantia book. I'd like to hear you talk a bit about that.
Well, you know, again, there are healers of all different kinds, and but I think that the truth of it is, for the people that are actually honest about it. Now, I'm sure that there are people out there that are self-deceived, and I'm sure that there are people out there that are fraudulent. But I also know that there is a certain sector of healers that are actually doing something. And so, you know, if I had, and I think that a lot of them are doing it through a type of structure that I would consider, eccentric or whatever, and that doesn't matter. But the question to these people was, because I also represented our Universal Father as much as I could to every single person there, including the vendors. So my question to them was, then, well, tell me about this energy that you're receiving and channeling. How does that work? How does that feel? What do you call on? And then they would tell me, and then that would open it up to so many things from the Arantia book, the various circuits, the connectivity that we have through cosmic mind, the connectivity that we have with our ministering angels, so many different things, but it's the question that opens the person up, and it's the question, the answer to those questions that informs us with the help of our thought adjuster, with the help of our ministering angels, to see the opening to approach that person about the book.
And maybe you can give me another example of how that conversation might go.
Well, for example, I remember one healer telling me that she worked with angels. And so that led us into, a conversation of how she saw her angel, how angels direct us to things, and how angels are ministering spirits. And how working as a healer is actually a walk in faith, because if the person believes that they are a so-called healer and that they can receive and channel this energy and they're doing it, then they're certainly acting on whatever truth they've been given to understand for themselves. But it's opening them up to an expanded framework of ministering angels and cosmic energy and that sort of thing that piques their interest about the book.
Right.
I hope that helped.
No, that's very helpful. And I think it's also really inspired, frankly. I really
I don't know that. I certainly hope so, but I can tell you that that all of this is not originating from me. I think that a lot of it is being willing to follow the leading of our thought adjuster, and to follow wherever we're being guided by, whether it's our angels or our thought adjuster or whatever, and then walking around with the expectation to be alert at all times, because we can expect people and things to come into our paths, and we just need to act on it. So that didn't come from me, so I think it is inspired.
Well, and it sounds like the way that you have incorporated the values and the ideas that exist in your audience, as you know, it's granted it's sort of broad brushstrokes.
Yes.
But you incorporate them into your presentation, if I understand correctly.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the talk that you gave at the last Metaphysical Festival, the one that was just a couple months ago or maybe last month?
Oh, yeah, it was back in March. Well, of course, the topic was the Rancher book, Compelling Evidence of ET Contact. It gave me, there were about 100 people there, and I started out by asking them why they were there. And I listed a few things, ETs, ET contact, UFOs, the law of attraction, and hands would come up at different times. There were a few readers of the book present, but maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15% were readers. But it gave me an opportunity then for me to tell them why I was there. And I think I may have been the only speaker there who really wasn't selling anything. I made it clear that, you know, even though these books are available for a nominal donation to the Urantia Book Fellowship, I was there simply for them. And, you know, I gave a personal testimony of how the book changed my life and has been a great tool to me personally toward having a deeper relationship with God and with my brothers and sisters, and has been a great tool in helping me to achieve that, or to realize that peace which passes all understanding. And the only reason I was there that day was because I wanted them to have that as well. And so, you know, so that just, I think, changed the whole atmosphere from someone trying to sell them a bill of goods to someone who was there for their well-being. And so from there we talked about, you know, if I'm going to give evidence of ET contact, then we had to talk about truth. And we had to talk about evidence and different kinds of evidence. And then from there talked about some of the different authors of the book, some of the different extraterrestrials that came to Earth. We talked about Adam and Eve. We talked about Melchizedek. We talked about Jesus of Nazareth. We talked about many of these people. And I've got to say that Halbert Katzen's work was a great help to me as far as providing empirical evidence that supports a lot of the things that are in the book, particularly when we talked about Adam and Eve. I was able to, using his work, was able to show that scientists have found that there was a gene that entered the gene pool 37,000 years ago in Mesopotamia that had to do with improving brain function. And it was little things like that, and then it kind of ended up with talking about what the book tells us about the inhabited worlds. I think it's paper 49. I talked a great deal about that. But to start
I'm going to interrupt you just a second here, just to let people know who may not be familiar with Halbert Katzen's work.
Okay,
that you can find out more about the work he's done, the reports that he's written and that others have written, and the type of outreach he's doing on ubthenews.com or .org. I think it's .com, ubthenews.com. And he has been doing work with academia, trying to get serious study and research of history in the Urantia book. Go on. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say that one of the first things that I did during my speaking presentation was to grab the audience by bringing them through a visualization. And because my whole approach with the subject matter was to look at it through the eyes of a cosmic citizen. And when you introduced me, you said that I was an executive with a healthcare company, and that's true, but by trade, I'm an old occupational therapist, and I understand how to use activities to affect a realization with a person. So we took a little visualization trip back to when they were when the first time that they looked up at the sky and saw the Milky Way, and how did that make them feel? And so that kind of brought them to, well, you know, I am a cosmic citizen. You know, I am made of the same stardust, that I am connected with all of the forces and circuits and gravity circuits and spiritual circuits and all of the pulsating life of the universe. I'm part of that. And I thought that was very helpful.
I think that's just a remarkable segue. That's really beautiful.
So,
and I would imagine very effective.
Well, you know, I think it was effective. I had a good friend of mine that I work with who was part of the audience, and she was a good reality test for me, and said that it was an excellent exercise. So, you know, I say that not to to impress everyone with how wonderful I was, but I say that because I think it's really important that we really meditate and ask for assistance before we're making any presentations or doing something that we think we need to do or have been called to do. And in some of my stillness afterwards, it came to me to do this. And it worked very well.
And what was the outcome of that? I mean, of that presentation, what kind of feedback did you get from the people in the audience?
Well, I actually ran very close to time and didn't get to do everything that I planned to do, which I guess was a good thing. But afterwards, many people came up to me, came back to my booth, and bought the book. I probably sold 10 books after that presentation. I sold 41 books in total that weekend.
Wow.
Many
41
people,
books in one weekend?
Yes. Well, I had a lot of help. You know, I had thought adjusters working together. I had angels directing people to my booth. And, you know, if it looked like there was one man behind that booth, there were lots of lots of help, not just one person. But there were people who came up to me and thanked me, and there was one woman who told me that she was actually in tears when she came back to my booth, and she was in tears during my presentation, and of course I didn't know why. And she told me that she has a son who's autistic and who is now a teenager and doing fairly well. But when he was very young, I want to say, if I'm remembering this story correctly, he was maybe 4 or 5 years old, and he would write things over and over and over again. And one word that child wrote over and over and over again was the word Urantia.
No kidding.
And she said, until I saw Urantia listed as being involved in this metaphysical festival, she said, I had no idea what that meant. And so, that gives me chills talking about it now. But isn't there a great lesson in that? We never know what brings people to us. We never know what the deeper meaning is for them. All we can do is act. You know, the action is ours and the consequence is God's. And I just don't find anything truer than that. But anyway, as an outcome of the weekend and the presentation, I've been asked to do another festival this fall, which I'll be glad to do. And we have now a list of probably 30, 35 new contacts of new readers, and Don Ware, who was on this show earlier today, and I are working in cooperation and coordination in bringing these people into study groups. So he's starting a new study group in his area. We're going to be starting a study group in the north end of the counties along this part of the state. It's, for those not familiar with Florida, we live in a very big state, and if you can picture the state of Florida and look over to your extreme left, we are in the central Gulf Coast. We are as far over in the state as you can get before you get to Alabama. So we're hardly Floridian. I think we're more deep south than anything. But we're going to be starting a new study group in the Panama City area, which is something that I've been wanting to do for years. And our Gulf Breeze Pensacola group will be expanding. The first Monday of the month, I'm going to be calling all of these new people in, and we'll be giving an overview of the book to kind of get things started. And so, you know, you just never know what all of this will reap for you. You just have to go with what you're given and walk in faith.
Well, I think I'll give you a little bit of info then, because I just found Halbert's syllabus on his website, and I was really moved. He's done a really good job with this, and this is the syllabus that he gave to the comparative religions professor at a college in Ohio, or university in Ohio, and she actually uses this in her comparative religions class where she's teaching the Urantia book along with a variety of other overviews of different religions around the world. And it's a fairly brief overview of the book, but then what he does is he gives some really beautiful sequences of quotes from the book that are all profoundly spiritually moving. And if you haven't taken a look at that, take a look at it, because that is a
wonderful thing that he pulled together. And in fact, I use it. I have a copy. I keep it with me, and I use it a lot.
Oh, so you're familiar with it.
I'm very familiar with it, yes. Yeah. It's very helpful, especially if, for those listening in starting new groups. I think that can be very helpful as a tool to kind of help you with an overview of a lot of the concepts in the book, to kind of give them a taste of what they're going to be studying, and hopefully to motivate them to study.
Right, right. And I also wanted to talk a little bit, we've got about 12 minutes left of the show, and I wanted to talk a little bit about your interest in the 50K project and your request to be involved and invitation to be a team leader in that project, and also about the upcoming conference. Memorial Weekend in Florida the students of the Urantia book.
Okay. Well, the 50K and 5, I think it's just a wonderful program, a wonderful approach. And I think that the fellowship just for the last 50 years, has just been so great in providing leadership and tools to assist us individuals who are interested in getting the book out to as many people as possible. And I think that this is just a great structure and just a great program in how to do that. And I also think that 50,000 people, to touch 50,000 people and get 50,000 books out there in the next 5 years, is a very achievable goal. And my interest in it is, of course, bear fruit in the soil in which you're planted. You know, that's what I've been trying to do here with people in my geographical area and their interests. But, you know, you look at all of the lives that, that Don Ware has touched with the book, and all of the people that I've come in contact with just in March. I probably shook hands with more than 500 people and talked with more people than that and planted seeds about the book, sold 41 books. Now, I'm just one person. So if everyone out there would work in concert, we're going to get this message out to more than 50,000 people in the next 5 years. So I think so my interest in it is I just expect things to come my way. And when I saw this, I thought, well, maybe this is something that I need to get involved in, and why not? Why not include that with everything else that I'm doing? So there I am with it.
Well, I don't know if you happened to get the email that Thomas Orgula sent out this last week. I think it was just Thursday or Friday, but he reached his 100th person that he had introduced the book to since the beginning of the year.
Oh, my goodness.
Just this last week. And he's actually kept track of every person he's introduced the book to, not necessarily by, like, name, phone number, and email address, but just, you know, wrote like a diary or a journal of the people that he has met, that he has come along. And I just wanted to sort of give a shout-out to Thomas Orgula, because this 50K in 5 project is his sort of brainchild. And as the chairman of the outreach committee for the fellowship, he brought up the idea that the fellowship support or sponsor this project, and that they agreed, they voted on it and agreed. And so we are now in the process, or he is now, and others are getting involved in developing outreach tools that are really effective.
That's great.
And I'm hoping that we can incorporate some of your experience and expertise and wisdom, as well as others like Don and Halbert and Chris Alverson and many people who have been doing outreach for years, and to help develop some real effective tools in this mission.
Yes, I did not receive that particular email. I'll have to write him and ask him to send it to me. But it's a great thing, and I think it speaks very well not only for him coming up with this, but also for the fellowship and getting behind it and helping to move it forward. So I think it's exciting.
The other thing that I think is also quite profound about his vision for that is that he's really trying to focus on youth, college age, and young adults.
Yes.
And you mentioned that you were first introduced to the book when you were like 19 or 20, I believe.
Yes, I was 20 years old. Yep, I was in my second year of college.
And even though you said it wasn't something that you read, you know, actively or really in a committed way until some years later, it was still what you called your touchstone.
Yes.
And I thought that was just such a beautiful description. So,
yes,
you know, I think that... Go ahead.
Well, yes, it became a touchstone without ever really thinking about it. One day I just realized that, you know, I'm comparing everything against the Your Answer book. I need to start reading the Your Answer book and really study it.
Right.
You know, it was a realization. But go ahead, I interrupted you.
Well, no, that's basically what I wanted to say. It's just that he's really got a profound vision about what we can do if we all work together in concert to make this happen.
Absolutely. And we're supposed to do it in concert. We're supposed to do it with others. We're supposed to do things individually, but I think that we're also supposed to pool our resources and our work, and because that becomes synergistic. If the outcome of that becomes more than just the sum of all of the parts contributing to it, you get a greater outcome. So I think so. And I think that, you know, it's very important to consider college-age people because, well, not just college-age, I think even older people that go back to college are looking. They're truth-seeking. Not everyone is looking for the best way to get an education to make the most money. I think about people that I've met in philosophy classes and psychology classes, comparative religion classes. I think that it's no coincidence that Dr. James Mills, who many may recall the name, he was a foundation trustee after Christie.
Right, Jim Mills.
Jim Mills was the chairman of the philosophy department at the University of West Florida here in Pensacola, and I had the wonderful privilege of meeting him about 30 years ago. But I don't think that it was any coincidence at all that Jim was working with students reading, understanding philosophy and looking for truth. What a great place for him to be. I wonder how many, I can only imagine how many people he reached.
Right. Well, we are down to the last 5 minutes of the show, and I would like to give you an opportunity to plug the conference coming up in Florida next month.
Oh, wonderful. You want to just
give us a little bit of information about that? And,
yes.
And then, Chris, I wanted to give you an opportunity to give some final comments or questions.
Okay. The annual Florida Students of the Urantia Book, FSUB, conference is coming up next month. It is a Memorial Weekend. And so, gosh, I don't have the dates of that in front of me, but it's, I want to say around the 21st.
I think it's the 22nd, 23rd, something like that.
And it is a, if you don't know this group, this is a wonderful group of people, just very loving people, and many longtime students. It's a retreat that actually engages you. I know that I don't have the list of all of the speakers yet, but I know that one of the topics will be on cosmology with modern astronomy. But there are all kinds of things. It's in a beautiful setting on a river near Bradenton, Florida. And if you would like more information on that, I can get it to you. I can be reached at my email address, ubookgb, for your Urantia Book Gulf Breeze, at AOL.com. And if you're interested in this, just put it in the subject line, and I will be glad to hook you up for more information. But it's something that I look forward to every year.
Well, wonderful. Chris, do you have any questions or comments for Arnie before we get off the air?
Don't have any questions, but I definitely want to have a comment. I just want to say bravo to you, Arnie. I think that you're doing magnificent work, and that I'm really impressed at your clarity of understanding and the calling that you have, you know, that sense of calling that you have, and more power to you. Excellent.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. But I've got to say that I have to take that with a grain of salt, so that I don't let my ego get in my way. And make it very clear that this is not Arnie. This is Arnie being used for something greater than himself. And I think that that's what we're all called to.
I understand that.
Agree.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I also want to thank our guest, Don Ware, who I believe is off the air now. But thank you very much, Don, for joining us. And thank you, Arnie, for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to spend this time with us.
It was a privilege. Thank you.
And thanks to all of our listeners, callers, and our chat room buddies, our chat room regulars, and some new people that popped on today. And I very much appreciate your participation and your questions and your support for the show and your ongoing support for this program. And I hope you have a really wonderful week, and look forward to having Paula and Andre back with us next week. And until then, I wish you all well and good cheer. Goodbye.
Shadows nor princes of evil.